Well, listen, one of my heroes, and I don't use that phrase lightly, is coming to Cambridge in just over a week's time. On Friday the 11th of February, he'll be on the stage at the Corn Exchange. It's an absolute joy to get the chance to talk to him today. It's Omid Jalili. Omid, hi.
Great to speak to you, Neil. Well, how wonderful to be here. What a lovely introduction.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry, but you're one of those guys who never fails to impress, never fails to amuse, never. And I say impress because you're known for your stand-up comedy, but you tackle some good subjects. And I mean, I'm going to say one of my favourite films is The Infidel, which is where you play an Arab guy who finds out that actually he's of Jewish descent. And yes, it's that challenge. I thought, that's a very brave thing to do. And you did it as a masterclass in how to bridge those gaps between cultures.
Yeah, well, I have to thank David Baddiel for that, because David Baddiel, that was his life. I think he said he got beaten up twice, once for being Jewish, once for being a Pakistani, because people didn't know what he was. And when I first saw him, I thought, oh, I like that guy. He's good to the Pakistanis are being represented in comedy, and I didn't know he was Jewish. But yeah, that was a fun film, and it won a clutch of awards, and yeah, it was nice to do a British comedy film. I think that was one notch on my belt I hadn't had at the time.
It is, but I mean, in fairness to yourself, even in your own write-ups, you're very self-effacing. But you know, you have described yourself as the generic Middle Eastern background character in so many films. You're in James Bond as the second Azerbaijani oil pipe attendant. Do those roles just sort of easily come your way?
I think I coined them the terms. I think the term I coined was ethnic scumbag specialist. That's kind of what I was doing. Yeah, and I think, look, at the end of the day, you get what you're given, and I was very, very grateful for it. And then, but that led on to me playing Picasso opposite Andy Garcia's Modigliani. I got to play some good roles, but the first love has always been stand up, and I was very lucky to be encouraged by some very special people. Whoopi Goldberg was one who I worked with her for a year in America, and she was always very encouraging, saying, "Now you people," and I kept saying, "Sorry, who's me? You people?" You know, wow. She said, "Let me be more specific. Brown people." I said, "How much more racist can you get?" And she said, "When you call me black, is we're black people, and you're like 30 years behind black people in stand-up comedy." And she kept telling me things like, "You know, you're the Richard Pryor of brown people." And I said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I'm more like the Ainsley Harriet of radio comedy." And she goes, "No." And I think she goes, "You've got to keep doing it, because people will try and pigeonhole you." And then fast forward exactly, my goodness, about 10 years later, and I got to meet Barry Cryer, who kept saying that he really loved my stand-up. He goes, "Now, the thing is with you, people will try and pigeonhole you." And exactly what he said, people will say you're my favorite Iranian comedian. They'll try. He goes, "But you don't. Let's be honest. You're a very good comedian by any. People will try and pigeonhole you, but don't be pigeonholed. Just keep doing what you're doing, and you'll be fine." So I think that to have encouragement from people like that was really key for me, because stand-up was always my first love, but I never really, you needed other people to encourage you, to remind you of that.
Well, I think as well, yours is one of those characters, and your background is, I mean, you were born in Chelsea, I'm right in saying, am I not? But your parents are Iranian, that you kind of, it gives you permission, doesn't it? There's so many other stand-up comedians who can't talk about this or can't do that, and we are in a very sort of woke culture now, whatever. You're okay, you're kind of immune in so many ways, aren't you? Because you bridge those gaps, as we said before.
I think I can also make fun of my Britishness as well, because being raised in Kensington, opposite Kensington Palace, I can joke about it and say, you know, I'm embarrassed that we're so posh. Kensington is the first borough in London to open up a Kentucky Fried Pheasant. Silver spoon licking good with the tagline. So I can make fun of that side of me as well. So yeah, I think that right now, it's such a fertile time for comedy, and everyone's really ready for live comedy. We've seen so much of it on our laptops, on our iPhones. We've been watching things digitally, but actually to experience some of the live experience is actually good for you physiologically. Mm. That's why I've been getting so many tweets. Eddie Marsan sent me an amazing tweet, the actor Eddie Marsan, said that he didn't know how much he needed it. He felt relieved and sent me a text saying, I feel different. I've got little wings on my shoes and I feel great.
Yeah.
And it's different. It is different watching comedy live. And you can see the way people, when they watch you, when they laugh, they turn to their friend. Like, did you get that? It's a communal experience.
Absolutely.
And watching that is, it really encourages you. So then you get better. It's an amazing symbiosis and exchange of energies that creates a really memorable night. So I it's been wonderful to be on tour.
Now let's talk about lockdown, though, because I interview quite a lot of musicians. And the trouble with musicians, they always say, oh, I've got so much music in me, if I just had the time to create. And then someone goes, well, there you go, there's 18 months of lockdown. And they go, yes, well, I painted the kitchen, really. That was all. How about you? I get the impression you would have been a caged animal.
I was, yes. And the first thing I started doing was, I started going to Richmond Park, and I punked a CNN, Anderson Cooper. I made out that there was a deer conference. The deer were discussing COVID, and we're just waiting for a statement. And the statement is that they want more pine cones. And he just, they just cut me off straight away because I pretended to be somebody. I somehow had a friend that punked him. So I started doing these updates from Richmond Park about frisbees that were stuck in the trees, and the deer have made more demands. So it was just a fun thing to do. And I realized on WhatsApp groups, they wanted it. And then that's why my show, I start showing some of the things I did just to keep the spirits up. I think that was a very important part of lockdown, that you didn't go mad. And I found that if I was just to do what the government asked me to do, which is sit down, watch Netflix and watch Piers Morgan get more and more wound up by the government. But we were told to do that. So we're all tweeting. If I just did that the whole time, I would have gone mad. So I did write stand-up as well, and I did do Zoom gigs. And I actually have to tell you, I really miss the way I used to end my Zoom gigs. The Zoom gig always finished in the toilet. And I'd say, this is the sound of my career. And I'd press flush on the toilet and put the camera of the computer down the bog. And it was such a fantastic way to end. So it was a great... I started enjoying Zoom gigs. I was a bit sad when we came back to the live thing. But yeah, it was about, and I reflect on how I was a caged animal, and I reflect on all the things comedians did with, like, the Zoom gigs, drive-in gigs, socially distanced gigs, you know, where gigs where everyone has to wear a mask, gigs where, you know, once I even did one gig where everyone had to wear masks. And I said, well, this isn't normal. They were going, no. I said, why don't we all just pretend that you're all ISIS hostages? And I'm like the terrorist just practicing his stand-up routine for the Ramadan party or something. And they loved it. I kept doing jokes. I said, who do I have to shoot to get a laugh around here? So it was a really funny thing. So it's about, you know, they say the animals that survive in the jungle, it's not the survival of the fittest. It's a survival of the animals who are the most likely to adapt. And I think that's the one, those of us who survived, we just tried to adapt.
I have got to ask you the question, though. It is on the PR stuff that came through. Apparently you did one Zoom meeting one Zoom gig where 629 people muted you. How did that happen? Was that days of technology?
No, I didn't know they could do that. That was, they were, there was a chat. I wasn't aware of chat. I was doing it on an iPad and I didn't know how to get into the chat. And I was getting frustrated because in those first Zoom gigs, some people would pay more to have their sound open. So I had to have and of course some of them were like saying, can you put the kettle on in the middle of, you know, in the middle of, let the cat in, the cat's by the cat flap. And it would ruin the punchlines. And I was like saying, I was like this, literally going, how do I mute you? And on the chat, they were like saying, let's all mute him. And suddenly, because some people are mute. And they told the guy running it, you mute everyone, just mute him as well. And so he muted me, and they all muted me. And I was talking, and I was going, can you hear me? They were going, no. And they were like giving me fingers. What's going on? What are you doing? And I didn't realize that. So then I just took the computer to the toilet.
Oh,
did my flush cap.
mayhem. But here you are. You'll be in Cambridge at the end of next week, back on stage, back as it is. Looking forward to it by the sound of you.
Oh, I am, yes. I think that Cambridge is probably one of my favourite gigs on the tour because they're very intelligent here. And I do have a Cambridge-related... I do a tribute to Sean Locke when he did King's College, Cambridge, when we all did it together. And there's a fabulous story, which is, I've been waiting to tell this story in Cambridge, which is very exciting, but I won't do it here.
No.
But also Cambridge, they're not just intelligent people, but they're very comedy literate. I find that there's no explaining to do of jokes. And there was I think they're the most comedy literate audience. I think they're a big crowd. There's about 2,000 or 3,000 people who see everyone. And that seems to be my audience. So they're an audience that's seen a lot of comedy. And as you get older, you find that is your audience, the people who've seen a lot of comedy. So there's lots of jokes about comedy and other comedians. And I think you have to kind of have seen some comedy to be able to appreciate it.
Well, and the thing is, we've known you now for quite some years now. So you're part of the institution now, and people just want to come and see people like you face to face and just be entertained one-on-one by you in the flesh on the stage. So I think it's going to be a fantastic gig.
They say there's a 25-year thing. When you hit 25 years in comedy, that's when you really find your voice. And I think the people who I've been doing comedy to have kind of grown with me, actually. So there are a lot of people between, I would say, 45 and 60 who I've grown up with. And they're the people who've seen me a lot, and they've seen a lot of comedy. So they're all looking for some. They're looking for all the new stuff that they could never think of themselves.
Bless you.
I'm there to deliver it for them.
And that's why you're in the audience at their gigs. So, yeah. I mean, I could talk all day to you. It's been an absolute joy to meet you. Thank you for being the hero I thought you would be. And good luck with the gig on the 11th here in Cambridge. And welcome to the Corn Exchange.
I'm
Jaloo. Thank you so much for joining us today.